Welcome to Nothing Venture with me, Ari Shah. Today on the podcast, I had with me Kiran Mehta. Kiran is an investment manager at Mercia Ventures. In today's podcast, we talked about you can't live in a parallel universe. So do what you love and do what you're great at.
You can't run a parallel universe. I think, you know, get into something, do something that you like today, and then kind of figure it out from there.
Prioritize working with really smart people, how venture is chaos, and why good founders will have a chance in any stage of the market.
You know, we look at really tough market conditions right now for raising capital, especially some of the later stage rounds, but good founders will have a choice in every single market.
The fact that founders need to internalize that growth is still really important, even as they have to become more capital efficient. And DEX and financial models are great, but really investors want to know what actions are going to get you to unlock the next milestones. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode. And if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Kiran, great to have you here in the studio with me.
Good to be here.
Let's dive straight in. So in your words, you left uni with two generic degrees from a mid-tier university, jack of all trades and master of none comes to mind. Believe me, I can relate. So before we get into your thoughts on venture, talk me through your thoughts on education in the UK and beyond in the context of some of the shifts we're seeing in tech, and more broadly, what do you think students should be prioritizing today, especially if they want to get into venture as you ultimately did?
Yeah, it's probably two different questions there. So state of education in the UK, I think moving super rapidly. If I think about job cycles, like people that I would have asked advice for when I was going through starting to go through university, it was all about blue collar work, you know, lawyer, accountant, finance, banking, all that other good stuff, which is great. And I kind of really enjoy it. You then hit the job market and you think, hang on a minute, why did I not train to be a developer? Because that's where all the cash is, that's where all the excitement is. And that is candidly where, if you're really entrepreneurial, you've got the lowest barriers to entry to start a business. You think, right, okay, so what I'm going to tell people, that younger people now that ask, I've got my partner's brother, we're kind of half a generation age gap. And he says, oh, what do you think I should do at university? What about being a developer? Kind of made sense 2 or 3 years back. And then ChatGPT happens, yeah. And all the other AI and LLM tools and low-code, no-code platforms and everything else like that hit the market. And you go, damn, I've just done what everyone did to me, where I've advised not what should you do at uni, but what should you have done at uni if you was hitting the job market today? And actually, you look at where we are now, it's probably a similar discussion with data scientists. You look at it and think, data scientists are going to rule the world in terms of their impact on tech, but ultimately, 5-10 years down the line, there's probably a no-code solution for that to be disrupted. So it always ends up a layer up. I guess the best advice would be just do something you enjoy, because everything's changing so quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had Sean Williams on the podcast, founder of AutoGen AI. He comes from very much a humanities background. He studied philosophy at university. He's exited one startup. He's now built and scaling AutoGen. And, you know, they were the first people to hire prompt engineers in the UK. And all of those prompt engineers came from humanities backgrounds. So, you know, people who'd done philosophy degrees or economics or English, right? People who understood how to ask and answer questions and how language worked so that they could ultimately, you know, train the LLM to do what they needed to do, which was ultimately in kind of bid tech. I kind of have a very similar philosophy for you. I don't know if it was kind of the Asian background as well. Was that part of like being pushed into the lawyer, banker, doctor kind of flow?
Yeah, it could have been. I'm not 100% sure. I definitely had some pretty pushy parents that always encouraged education and trying to kind of push you down that route. I wouldn't change it. I think I'm kind of really happy with how it's kind of played out. But I do think there's an interesting theme, just job market in general, as to those peaks and troughs and the higher paid jobs today people go for, and then you've got an excess supply. And so it's kind of economics 101, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, like I again, you know, did a humanities degree, ended up in business essentially, right? Ultimately, I think if I had it all to do again, with hindsight, and that's always a problem, right? You have the hindsight bias. I probably would have done something more along the lines of engineering. I love kind of that discipline, although have found it difficult to get into it later in life, although I'd done a little bit of it very early on, you know, when I was a lot younger. But what kind of shocked me, and this is a problem, you know, going to kind of private schools here in the UK, especially because they do push you down those sort of tracks and those sort of paths around kind of law, journalism, PP, those sort of things. You know, when I remember when I did my GCSEs, I did GCSE IT. That was, how do you create a PowerPoint presentation? How do you write a Word document? Like, it was that sort of stuff. It wasn't like technical coding skills. And in fact, the school didn't even offer computer science or, you know, coding as any kind of part of the curriculum, which I think has changed a bit, but still, I don't think nowhere near as much as I would have expected it to do. And I think you're right. I think 5 years ago, obviously going into engineering was almost a no-brainer. I think data science today is definitely, you know, one of the core valuable skills. But yes, I would equally suggest that, you know, it is likely to be disrupted. Like, we don't know where that will go, but there's always going to be a human involved in something. And it's just, what level of skill set do you need at that stage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can iterate quite a lot as well. You know, I've mentioned it earlier, just before we started recording, there's not, you can't run a parallel universe. I think, you know, get into something, do something that you like today, and then kind of figure it out from there. Like, I look back on some of my career choices. A lot of it's been luck. I got offered a couple of graduate schemes, ended up picking the one that was closest to home. What a great way to decide your career.
Yeah.
Finished a graduate scheme. The only thing that mattered was cash and location. Picked a job that had highest cash and highest and better location. And then my career's kind of gone off in that direction. I could have been doing something vastly, vastly different if I'd have picked a different route. May have been more happier, may have been less happier. I don't think you'll ever know.
Just
into it and crack on.
I think so. So let's talk about Mercia. How did you finally get the role there? And what does a day, month, or year in the life of working at Mercia look like for you? And what is it that you really love about the job?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I was moving house recently, and I found the old book collection, and there was the How to Break into VC book, which is wafer thin, but really, really useful. And you kind of, it puts into a good perspective to sort of look back and think, actually, where was I up to then? How did I get into it? And when you now get messages on LinkedIn of, hey, can you help me with network and thinking about how I get into venture, you go, oh, wow, actually, this has been a hell of a ride for the last 3 or 4 years. So how did I get into it? Applied for a lot of jobs, unsuccessful with quite a few. One of the bits that I've always prioritized in my career is working for really smart people. So the real estate fund that I worked for prior to joining Mercia, I was an associate in that fund. The investment manager that I worked for, really similar to me in terms of background, personality type, got on really well, and both equally wanted to move into venture and PE. Unlike me, he had a private equity background prior to that role. He joined Mercia. I asked, could you put a good word in? I got relatively far in the interview process, further than the other jobs where you're kind of not even getting a foot in the door. So he kind of got me a ticket to play. I was always really interested in venture. I spoke to him probably on a kind of quarterly basis anyway. He was always asking about, how's the job? What do you do? So it's kind of just learning by osmosis. There's a really good book. I think it's Brad Feld,
Venture Deals 2.0, yeah.
Yeah, that's like all the technical knowledge you'll ever need for kind of day one in venture. So read that, and yeah, just kind of went from there, really, which is, like I say, it's interesting to kind of look back on it. But yeah, that's how I got in.
Okay, and so what does the day, week, month, year in the life of look like for you, apart from posting on LinkedIn?
Yeah, so chaos, I think, is is what it looks like. No day that's the same, no week that's the same, and probably no month that's the same. One of the great things about venture is there's a lot of variety, and I say there's probably kind of five components to my role. So there's finding deals, which is out at events, doing podcasts, posting on LinkedIn, direct outreach, all that other good stuff. There's then kind of 2A and 2B. 2A being assessing, which is, does this fit into the market? Does it, you know, have you got a strong value proposition? Do we like the team here? All that other good stuff. 2B, because it's really got to be done in lockstep and it's a difficult balance to have, is you're kind of pushing and probing to get information out of management. You're asking the tough questions. You start with any meeting very pessimistic to try.
You've got to convince yourself to invest rather than convince yourself not to invest.
Yeah, exactly that. And the more knowledge you've got, the more likelihood you are to invest, because if you've not got knowledge, then you usually, and just in life as much as a venture role, if you've not got knowledge of something, you tend to assume the worst. Mm. So it's like, how do I really understand the nooks of what this business does? One, so I can digest it and make my decision, but equally you are championing that deal internally. And the last thing a founder ever wants, whilst they'd never recognize this in a meeting, is that they don't want you to have not asked enough questions so that you don't understand it well enough when you're feeding it back. So yeah, that bit's a challenge. And then the sort of 2B part of that is you've got to be someone that the founders want to work with. Mm. You know, we look at really tough market conditions right now for raising capital, especially some of the later stage rounds, but good founders will have a choice in every single market. So how do you push and probe and challenge, but equally you also helping the founder answer that question, the two main questions, which is one, can I work with this person? You know, your typical early stage venture deals, whilst people talk about that 2-3 year time horizon, actually, if you look at the bigger returns across most funds portfolios, it's 5, 10, even up to 12 years. That's a lot of days to come to work and not get on with someone. So, you know, the founder's got to really buy into you. And then equally, it's not just about getting on a personal level, but equally, you've got to be able to show that you can add value to that business. So that's a big component of it. And then the two final pieces, one is the transaction itself, which I would say is a little bit of the more boring stuff. You know, it's writing investment committee papers, it's dealing with legals, it's the kind of a little bit more in-depth due diligence. I like the due diligence part. The other two bits are just part of the process that I guess you've got to work through. And then the kind of final piece, which is probably the bit I enjoy most. And it's interesting to think of a career path in venture, because I think the longer you're in it, the more you start to enjoy this bit, which is the portfolio management side of it. So yeah, it can be anything. I can be getting up, recording a podcast, and then going to an event, not opening my laptop. I can be sat on my laptop, banging through 2 pages and investment committee papers and all that other stuff. Or I could be out at a strategy day for a portfolio company trying to think about how we solve problems in their business, whether it's go-to-market, tech, people, anything else.
And so at Mercy, I think, if I'm not mistaken, you have about 300 assets under management. Is that right? 300 odd?
Yeah, we've got a few different kind of bits with, obviously we've got venture debt, private equity. So sometimes we're a big business, sometimes you lose track of it, but yeah, ballpark about 300.
Right. So you're 300, let's say 300, and I don't know how many of those would obviously sit in your portfolio. And how much time are you spending post-investment kind of on any one particular business that you've invested in? Like what does that look like?
Again, back to the chaos theme, I think it kind of depends. It depends where each of those businesses are up to. If I kind of back solve it from a macro level, let's say there's 5 days in the week.
but let's say that for the purpose of this argument, yeah.
Yeah, we kind of broadly say a third, a third, a third in terms of sort of origination, new deals, actually doing deals and then supporting those companies afterwards. I think the portfolio stuff's a little bit higher than that. So yeah, call it 40%, 2 days a week. I've got 3 portfolio companies. So what's that? It's nearly a day a week across each of them, certainly like 2/3 of a day. But that will ebb and flow from some stuff that's going really well. They're not in a fundraise, business is performing. You want to continue to help and support with around the board table. But actually, you might just be having, you know, catch up with a CEO, one catch up with a chair in a board meeting. So that might be half a day's work. Conversely, you might either have challenges or you might have some really good stuff going on, especially around later stage rounds where that becomes a lot more intense. You know, and that's where you're getting into your day a week or a couple of day a week. But on average, probably 2 of the 5 split across 3 companies.
Because I, the reason I ask is this seems to me the least scalable part of venture, right? Like, so capital is scalable, clearly, right? Like even origination can be scalable because you can automate lots of stuff around that. The decision-making probably a little less scalable, but, you know, obviously there's a bunch of people looking at data-driven VC at the moment. And so possibly over time, and especially with, I guess, development within AI and generative AI, that might become a bit better. But actually that kind of hands-on portfolio management part of it is not scalable, because that's you as a human being. You only have 5-7 days, whatever the number is, but there is a limit to how much time you can spend, right? So at a certain stage, let's say you've got, you know, you've got three in the portfolio at the moment. Let's say that builds to 10. Are you able to do the origination plus the portfolio management plus plus everything else, like the diligence and assessment and the writing up the IC papers and all the rest of it, right? So how do you think about that? Like, does that kind of meant, like, so, you know, what happens if you've invested in 10 businesses and you're basically at a point where you can't take on more portfolio management, but the next deal comes along that is just absolutely stellar? Do you have to pass that on to someone else, or how does that work?
Yeah, so there's two components to that. So one, we're really fortunate at Mercia that we've got a portfolio team. So I think I've invested into 10 or 11 different businesses in the last nearly 4 years now. Obviously, I don't manage the kind of ongoing board support with that. We're lucky that we've got a portfolio team, and those guys and girls have got bigger portfolios because obviously they're not doing the origination and the and a lot of the transacting side of the role. So that's one way of scaling it at a business level. I think, how do you scale it at an individual portfolio level? It's kind of trying to solve some of the problems before they arise. I kind of think that investor on a board, around a board table, you're kind of trying to fill some of the gaps that are not there. So the businesses, they've got a really well-performing board, you know, good set of non-execs, quite a bit of independent support, good chair. You're sort of turning up, listening, feeding back, but it's a lot more strategic. It's a lot more high level. And the more you can do to put that in place early around building the right board and building the right structure around it, it's then not sucking up a lot of time, certainly on the challenges. It will always suck up time for the good stuff. But yeah, I think just getting the right people around the business. And that's one of the ways that, you know, I try and support a lot of the founders that I've invested, whether I've invested into the business of, it's quite hard if you're a founder, especially for us, where a lot of the deals, not exclusively, but a lot of the deals we do are regionally, you might not necessarily have that network of really good non-execs and chairs and advisors. So if we can help support that and amplify that and bring people into the business, more from a strategic level, like I say, around the board table, then that just makes our job a little bit easier as well.
Yeah, so it's scaling through people, but to your point, it's finding that right network of people to be able to do that. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's just one of these thoughts that kind of keeps going through my mind whenever I think about kind of venture as a business. Like, what are the bits that are scalable? What are the bits that aren't? Like, but the problem is, in order, and again, to your earlier point, Mercia has a billion quid under management, and presumably there are fees attached to that size of fund. But if you're a smaller fund, like if you're a 100 million fund or a 200 million fund or even a 50 million fund, you just don't have the fee capacity to be able to stack up people. Obviously, you're going to be making fewer investments, presumably, but because you're extracting fewer fees, it's going to be harder to scale up that sort of portfolio management side of things.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think you've always got economies of scale, you know, in any kind of business, in any sector. So it does definitely make it easier to do some of that stuff as you're bigger. But I think there's some learnings that can be applied at every single level, from large portfolios, small portfolios, and equally within individual portfolio companies themselves. And I think for me, the further out, it's kind of like when I remember when I was learning to drive, the only one bit of advice my dad always gave me was, if you're on the motorway, look at the second car ahead, don't look at the car directly in front of you, because 99 times out of 100, unless something's completely gone wrong, that first car in front of you will not break unless the one in front of them has. Yeah. And I kind of feel like that's how you deal with portfolio, right? If you're looking ahead on the bigger horizon risks and you're solving them today, you're then not getting dragged down in the firefighting stuff. And actually the people that you've brought in to help with the longer term piece, it's then easier to nip stuff in. I guess what we're trying to say, solve for tomorrow's problems.
Try and look ahead to what might be on the horizon and get ahead of those problems rather than waiting for them to come and bite you in the backside. So look, I'd love to have a free flow conversation about the state of venture today, especially as someone who is both relatively young, if you don't mind me saying, and relatively quote unquote new to the ecosystem, because you only started at Mercia in 21. So in fact, so much has changed in just the last 3 years that you've probably had some great exposure to that chaos roller coaster of venture, as you described it. But how do you think the ecosystem has and will change? And what do startups and founders need to think about to embrace and take advantage of those changes today?
A lot's definitely changed over the last couple of years. I think there's a lot of talk about capital efficiency and, you know, it's no longer growth at all costs, which I completely agree with. I think it's kind of weird, right? You look back on the market.
We both come from business backgrounds. Like, yeah, it's sort of, okay, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the market that we come out of and you go, this was kind of obvious. And I think, you know, certainly for me and for Mercer as a business, we've never been in that complete, you know, it's going to, you know, businesses are doing 10K of revenue and burning £1 million a month. Like, that's not the model that we've ever operated in. So I guess because you're not at the extreme end of the market, the change is a little bit less than some of the other stuff. But fundamentally, it's bizarre that you look back and say venture as an ecosystem has gone from just spend on marketing, spend on massive team before you've got a playbook to bring those people in and help them on board pretty quickly. So that's a positive change. I think the bit that maybe needs to be, I guess, understood by founders that the market isn't really saying right now is growth is still very, very important.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at a venture business and you look at kind of valuation curves and valuation metrics, in the early days, you invest for potential. In the kind of middle days, you invest on some sort of revenue metric. And ultimately, every business at some point has got to make some capital. And then that will be an EBITDA measure. So if that business is not growing rapidly enough that you can make them transitions from essentially kind of future value and opportunity costs into revenue, into EBITDA, that business is not going to make it. So companies growing 30% year on year, probably struggling to raise in this climate, even if they pass break even, if they're trying to raise venture capital. But equally, yeah, growing 100% year on year with a 5x burn multiple is equally not working.
Yeah, I mean, I think I 100% agree. I think I can't remember who it was that said this. I think it was someone on Twitter, because it always is. I think it was Gil Dibner, to be honest. But it's now it's the intersection of venture style growth with capital efficiency. Right. So,
yeah.
So how do you burn less whilst growing harder and faster, which obviously up until now, or certainly over the last sort of 5-10 years, was not the equation that most founders are working to. They're like, okay, we just toss more fuel on the fire, burn more on marketing, throw it into teams, as you said, whatever it might be. But now it's okay. How do we actually achieve? So A, how do we lengthen our runways? But still achieve those revenue and growth targets and start delivering cash and value down to the bottom line. I think the one thing that you said there that I think is still that kind of up in the air question for a lot of founders is do they pursue profitability or at least cash break even, or do they remain loss making? I think that's a really difficult fence to straddle, right? Because often if you are pursuing cash break even profitability, you have to slow the roll a little bit, right? Because you can't invest in as much in teams or marketing or kind of discretionary spend, and then that potentially has an impact on growth. So your business has to fundamentally in and of itself be one that scales without those additional costs in it to be able to get to that revenue. So when founders then look at making that decision, do I move towards profitability or do I keep burning? The issue then becomes, well, if they move towards profitability, can they maintain that growth curve? And if they can't, then to your point, it's going to be harder to raise venture, because that fundamental point around venture has not changed in the sense that venture is still a business of outliers. It's still looking for the billion, the 10 billion, whatever dollar exit, as opposed to a slow and steady, you know, dividend yielding business.
Yeah, no, agreed. It's definitely a hard tightrope to walk. I think one of the ways I always think about it is you can pursue a strategy of getting towards break even and then decide that you're going to ramp up overheads from there. If you think of your typical venture backed business, you know, someone will be a pick a number between 12 and 24 months. That's probably your average cash runway. Let's call it 18. If you, based on your overheads today, you're going to lay down some costs anyway. You are going to be burning, because if you're not burning and you've not got a model that shows that you're burning, then you're not going to raise anything.
You're not
capital.
Going to raise anything, yeah.
So you've got, you know, kind of at least 6 months probably of get that team in, get them operational, start to see some outputs. You've probably got another 6 where they're scaling. And then you've got this kind of window that says, do I continue to ramp? Do I now know that what I put in the top is going to translate at least to revenue and some level of profitable revenue, even if it's not covering the whole of
at
your
overhead? At least at economic level, it needs to be profitable and, yeah.
Yeah, exactly that. And then so you've got this window where you've got probably 6 months up to your next round where you can either go quicker and then you're doubling down of I've got to raise a round, or you can pursue break even based on your current overhead, and then you've got optionality around what that next funding round might look like. And I think there'll be that will change a lot in the next couple of years. And I'm already seeing some of that wash through. So if you think about a pure software business, which is where I spend a lot of my time, typically 80%, I say typically, even more typically in this market, 80%-ish gross profit margin. Mm. So actually, if you're getting to $1 million, $2 million quid of revenue, that is still quite a lot of capital for you to reinvest back in, well, first to cover overheads and then reinvest back into growth. So actually, I'm seeing a few businesses at the moment, and it's different for different sectors and depends on the market and where you fit in and how quick you think someone's going to try and come along and take over from you. But I'm seeing businesses doing seed rounds, getting to Series A raises and doing another seed round in terms of the amount they're raising.
Yeah,
obviously, the valuation's gone up, but they're going, I can't always deploy this now. Some businesses can, and that's great. But others are going, actually, if you give me another $1-2 million, I can repeat what I've done last time out, and maybe there's an A round at the end of it, or maybe there's a different funding strategy. Mm. But I think that just double or triple your round size, double and triple your valuation every 12 months.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the way to plan. If it works and it's right for certain businesses, then I think that makes sense. But yeah, it's definitely not all businesses now.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely say on the software, and I mean, this, you know, certainly SaaS businesses, right? So because of the way the business model works, in theory, after a certain point, you should be able to grow efficiently with to exactly to your point, the cash that you're generating out of the business itself. And therefore that need to raise capital on an ongoing basis shouldn't necessarily be there. And I think the way founders, I think, have started thinking about it as well, actually what this means is I can own more of my business at the end as well, right? So actually, if I'm only raising, you know, two at a 40 million valuation at Series A rather than a 10 million ticket at 50 million, right? Like, they're going to dilute a lot less. And equally, they're probably under less strain, right? In terms of what milestones they need to get to, because they've taken less investment. They're seeing higher probability of success because the business is driving most of the returns anyway, rather than using the capital to kind of drive those returns, if I can put it that way. So actually it works out better for them. Where I think venture still has a massive role to play, and what I'm seeing in the market, I guess, more than anything else is, I think I've said it a few times here, is a lot of cash being deployed into more R&D heavy businesses. So deep tech, hardware, life sciences, et cetera.
Yeah, no, agreed. I think that's definitely the trend. It's interesting to try and work out what's driving that trend, because there's a few different bits in and amongst all that.
Apart from anything else, you've got to deploy the capital, I guess, is one of the reasons, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But equally, software sales have been really challenging to come by last year. If you think about whether it's me or you looking at, do we really need Netflix, Prime, Disney, you know, the other five streaming subscriptions.
They are screaming, but
that we sign up to, or a CFO going, hang on a minute, there's 100 grand a year going out on my business on
software.
Do
I need Monday.com or can I use a spreadsheet, basically? Yeah,
exactly that. And I think that's been hard through last year. Q1 this year, it's only one quarter, so it might be an anomaly, but certainly across the businesses I'm involved in, and then a lot of the MI that I see from kind of founders looking to raise, it feels like that's opening up again a little bit. But whenever you got a change in the market, it then changes how people think about it, both founders and investors. And I think there's a lot of founders that are saying, actually, is there a different way of me doing this? There's still a bit of the education piece on how big does a business need to be to attract venture capital. Mm. I met a company at the height of when everyone was raising some crazy rounds. They was doing about 4 million of ARR. It was spitting off 1 million of cash. There was an angel investor that owned about 10% of the business, and there was two founders that owned the remaining 90%. And I remember having the discussion of, there's two of you, you own 90% of a business that's generating $1 million quid of free cash flows a year. Yeah. Whilst you're still probably investing for growth. So actually, you know, you may be able to get it to 1.5-2 million quid if you were just running it for profit. You've got a great business. But a lot of that, with the mood music at the time of you've got to raise big rounds, big valuations, I think at times I almost felt like, I've got great traction, why am I not getting there? And it wasn't a market that I felt was big enough to support venture returns. But I spent quite a lot of time with the guys to say,
why?
You're doing this right.
Yeah.
You know, you've made a life-changing business for at least yourselves, if not others around you. Just continue to run it, and they were, you know, relatively young guys. See what comes next as well.
Yeah, I think that narrative, I wouldn't say it's, I still get the feeling, I mean, I sit on a lot of kind of founder groups and so on, still get the feeling that you know, venture is the goal for so many people. And I sit there and look, Maybe it's because I know, as I said to you earlier, I'm not that guy. I'm not gonna build that $1 billion business. I'm not interested in building that $1 billion business necessarily. Or if I were to build a $1 billion business, it would probably be by accident. But it still feels like people are chasing the tech crunch, not necessarily chasing the tech crunch article anymore, but they are still chasing the validation, I think, that they think that venture brings to their business. Whereas, like, for me, the best validation is you've got a great business that is throwing off cash. Like there's nothing wrong with that. And indeed, obviously, as we know, right, the metrics on venture is that 90% of them do fail, right? So actually taking venture, you are taking a bet. You are taking an outsized bet, probably on your failure rather than your success.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And probably unsurprisingly, with how controversial I am on some things, one of my favorite reads is Factfulness. And one of the bits it always talks about in there is you need to check the graveyard. You know, for all the big success stories of billion-pound exits and founders, you know, riding around on yachts, actually go back and look at that. To your point, you know, 90%, depending on when you kind of start the clock rolling, 90% of businesses fail. Even those that have raised cash have got quite a high failure rate, and the market, as we touched on previously, the market's got to be big enough so that they can generate those level of returns, but they are the ones that make it onto Crunchbase and even that and TechCrunch and everything.
It's survivorship bias, right? Like, ultimately.
Yeah, exactly that. And then you kind of glamorize that, and more like, to your point, more and more people want that validation. But ultimately, running a business funded by customers, making revenue, that is the way that the majority of businesses in the UK economy and global economy start and thrive. Venture's right for a very small amount of businesses. And I think as an industry, we need to go deeper and bigger into those businesses where we can really change the dial, and there can be big societal changes, instead of going, let's try and create an environment where everybody wants to raise funding because there's very little business readiness support, but there's a lot of investor readiness support. And actually, they've been the other way around. Let's help people build a good business. And then for the ones that venture makes sense, how do we push them in the right direction?
I would subscribe to that 100%. I've always said it myself. I mean, like, one of the things I think about is, like, a lot of the amazing outcomes from the outside, founders are left with 3% of their business, 2%, 5%, right? They've been diluted down to nothing. I mean, there was a recent one that was, you know, doing the rounds on Twitter, $500 million exit, but founders came out with nothing, like, because of all the preference stacks that were in there. I mean, they just didn't make any money out of this business that they ended up selling for $500 million. Like, that to me is absolutely crazy, right? Like, yes, you've got the kudos of having sold your business, but, like, you actually have ended up with nothing, having spent 10, 15 years of your life sweating at it. And yes, I think there is that problem of, I think that there's two strands here, right? So there is that lack of business support, yes. But I think in the UK and Europe more broadly, and we've had this conversation on this podcast quite a few times, just that environment for those outsized outcomes doesn't seem to be there in the same way that it is in the US, which is a shame, right? Because you see all these businesses flooding or certainly trying to seek venture. But actually, the success stories in the UK have been so little, and Europe in general have been actually quite limited. So it feels like they're chasing a dream that doesn't even really exist in over here, as opposed to, say, in the US, right?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of factors in that. So I suspect the chat was one of the podcast with Danny, because I've had that discussion with him many times over. And I completely agree with that. You know, you look at the unicorn rate in the UK and Europe compared to the US, it's definitely not there. There's a million and one factors that kind of feed into that, obviously including population size, right? You've got to get a much greater market share in the UK, you know, compared to the US, which I think 7 or 8 times the amount of people, other factors that play into it. But even that on its own, you know, makes it significantly harder. I think it's about, to help us as an ecosystem, working out what does success look like.
Yeah.
You know, I always think there's a hard decision that we often have to make, which is, does a founder really want to go to a level which generates returns that are interesting for the fund?
Do they want to, and can they?
Yeah, no, exactly that. I think the can they bits make a lot of people kind of get that. The bit that I think is harder to work out is, do people want to? So if we, you know, if we use an arbitrary example, if we was to invest into a business at £5 to £10 million valuation, venture level returns, we talked about some of the failure rates in venture, you're kind of at least shooting for a 50 to 100 mil exit. But let's say you own 20% of that business. They've not raised institutional cash before and you've got a pretty clean cap table. You might have two founders that own 30, 40% of the business each. Actually, if they can sell for 10 million, that's just changed their lives.
It's a great outcome for them. Yeah, 100%.
I think it's all about motivations, right timing, accepting that there's not a lot of UK-based unicorns. Certainly, if you look at it from unicorns that people have got liquid on as opposed to some of the paper valuations in the last couple of years. So then what does that mean? And I think you mentioned it earlier in terms of focusing more on R&D in the earlier stage. You know, if investors are getting involved earlier, they don't need a business to be a billion-pound business to generate 10x returns.
Yeah, 100%. So I know you don't like living in a parallel universe, but if you were to fast forward, let's say, 10 years, what do you think venture might look like? What's your best guess?
What might it look like, or what do I want it to look like?
Ooh. Well, what would you like? What would you like it to look like? And where do you think the challenges will come in trying to get it to that stage?
So I definitely like it to be a much more kind of open and transparent space. So like a lot of the stuff that I do in terms of the conversations that I have, the LinkedIn posts, everything else like that, is to try and break down some of the barriers to move away from some of the challenges that we've talked about today, which is everybody wants to raise venture because it's glamorous and actually let's just double down on the businesses where the venture model fits. So I think definitely would like to see that. It'd be quite good to see an evolution of how a fundraising process works. Mm. If we think about financial models, pitch decks, all really useful, but does that really get to the nub of, you know, what you're trying to do? Video presentations, you know, meeting people face-to-face, all the other smart stuff that's coming out with AI, what can we do to kind of reinvent this that you don't just get words on a paper? Because, you know, the venture funnel is, as you'll know, it's really wide, right? You'll get, you know, venture funds typically do about 1% of the deal flow that they see. And as a result of that, that first level color's got to be so wide. And you're reading numbers on a piece of paper, but the founders that really stand out are the ones that can articulate their vision, their views, why they're the right team to solve the problem. That you're just never going to come across on a piece of paper. So I think just a rethink of how we do that. And again, it's kind of venture and business. Mm. How do we do that in the space where we don't do 1% of the deals we see because everyone understands what a good venture deal looks like? Mm. So yeah, that's definitely what I'd want to see, I want to see more of. I think more and more of doing stuff that's actual big society changing events. And you know, I challenge myself with that every day. It's hard. It's not impossible, but it's hard to kind of...
It's harder in software, I would say, as well, yeah.
And some of the hardware stuff. But yeah, how do we do stuff that really moves the dial and is innovative and funding more innovation than the 2021, 2022 years where there was a lot of funding into businesses that shouldn't have had it and probably didn't need it?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things there. So Mark Cohen, who's been on the podcast before from Unbundled, I mean, like he's a solo GP, kind of invested off his own balance sheet at the moment. But his process is no deck, video, right? Five-minute video, pitch him, because, you know, his whole thesis is if you can't sell, that's a fundamental, you know, fundamental need in any business. You're selling to either your clients, your employees, to investors, to whoever, right? So you need to be able to articulate exactly as you say, articulate what your vision and opportunity with the business is clearly and directly in a video, and then from there he takes it to face to face and so on and so forth. So I think, yeah, I always go hot and cold on pitch decks because I'm like, everyone now has the formula.
Yeah.
Right? Everyone knows it's, you know, problem, solution, team, market, you know. So how much information can you get out there? And how much bullshit is there in most of those decks, right? Like any market sizing that I see is rubbish. Any competitor slide I see is engineered because it's always like, okay, what are the things that we do differently? And let's just make sure that they are different enough from everyone else and we'll just cross those boxes out.
Yeah.
But actually, if you were really, really thinking about what makes your business different, it probably wouldn't be in terms of what your competitors are doing. It's actually, what are you doing rather than how are you doing it differently kind of thing. And then, you know, I know you've had this argument with a few people around the value of financial models, certainly at kind of pre-seed, you know, definitely that debate is one I'm more than up for having maybe on a separate conversation. But again, I would agree, like there is limited value in a really in-depth financial model, certainly at certain stages. I actually prefer, as an example, long-form memos, right? Like, because I think structurally they help understand the thought process of the founder, because if they can write a really well-structured memo, and it doesn't need to be, a huge memo, but like, you know, one or two pages long. Apart from anything else, that makes your job easier as an investor, right? Because that stuff that you could potentially lift into your own kind of IC memos and so on. But actually, it gives a clearer thought process than the deck, which I always say a deck is a foot in the door. It's not like no one raises investment off a deck. Great decks get meetings. Great founders get investing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. And I think one of the big points for me is that I'm not against pitch decks and I'm not against financial models, but I think they're so taken out of context.
Yeah.
If we think of like the classic financial model, the biggest thing for me is what proof points are you going to get that unlocks that next level of scale?
You know,
have you got another, even if it's revenue based, and there's some really cool models out there where it'll link to when we get 2x revenue, it switches on X or Y headcount. But where's that revenue come from? Is that more founder-led sales? Because if it is, then we maybe don't want to ingest another salesperson. Is it more, has it come through really hot marketing lead and products just gone viral and people have self-signed up on the website? Again, it's maybe not sales. If it's you've brought in someone with a really long industry black book and he or she's closed a lot of deals, then again, that's where you double down. So I think there's so many nuances within every business that the best... I think there's a huge place for financial models. The very best ones would be the ones that have got multiple scenarios, but I think it's really difficult at an early stage to kind of articulate that, which goes back to kind of one of the earlier themes about transparency. It's kind of a two-way street. The fundraising process, I think part of it does need a change because it highly indexes for spin, polish and extroverts. And obviously an investor's job is to look through that. And actually, I think statistically, it's more likely to have an outsized return if it's more of an introverted CEO, which kind of breaks some of the, well, why do we do this, come in and pitch and do a polished pitch deck and everything else? But I just love conversations of sitting across with a founder and asking that, of challenging the assumptions. I think the assumptions are more important than what does that hockey stick look like. How are you think, especially on the go-to-market stuff, you're probably gathering them a bit of a nerd in terms of sales and marketing, of how do you really understand what's the core data that we don't ramp up a sales team when marketing's working and we don't ramp up a marketing team when sales are working because we've tracked the wrong data. And then as a result, actually, we've now got a huge sales and marketing team, but we've got 2 million of ARR that all comes from founder-led sales.
which is often the big mistake, right, that a lot of founders make, which is assuming that a sales team will replicate what the founder has done, and then assuming that each individual member of that sales team will drive the same level of sales, right? You're going to have a curve, a bell curve of, you know, better performers and worse performers. And again, this is the challenge when you're building a financial model as well, is like, how do you average that out? Should you average that out, right? Because reality is that anything that you're doing that is forecasting is 99% inaccurate anyway, right? It is to an extent finger in the air. The best founders I know how to take precise data-led bets, but with the flexibility to change those bets if they need to.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, you think about averages. There's the saying about the average person has got one breast and one testicle.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And that will be someone will have followed the data. You know, if they index across the whole population, the outcome would be that the average person has one breast and one testicle, which obviously very few people have.
Yeah.
So I think for me, that's, you know, some of that controversial thinking, and what you need in a venture fund when you're trying to get outsized returns is really challenging that. If the model's based on averages, then it's definitely wrong. If there's three scenarios that talks about, well, actually, if it's founder-led sales, we switch X, and if it's sales, we switch Y, and if, you know, I think that's where a lot of the value is.
It's more valuable, yeah.
And that might be a model, that might be a conversation.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, and actually, it's the same in venture. It's like, it's bizarre, but, you know, people talk about venture. Often you'll see kind of press talking about venture in terms of averages, but venture is a game of outliers. And therefore, you know, if you say the average venture fund, you know, returns 1.5x or 1.8x or whatever it is, that's the wrong conversation to be having. You've got to be talking about, well, okay, what are the ones that are returning 17x or 100x or 20x or whatever the number is. But looking at venture as a game of averages just doesn't work. I want to finish off with one final question. Which is, what is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work and venture, politics, socially, or at home? What is a hill that you would die on defending? And it doesn't need to be whether or not you need a financial model.
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult question because we, I think we generally hang around with quite a few controversial people. So then you kind of think, well, everything.
Am I being controversial enough?
Yeah, like, have I got to the point where my conventional thinking is actually very different to others? But there was a couple that I was thinking of, because I know you asked this question to most people, and some of them have come up through the theme. So in order to avoid saying something that we've already spoke about, I think for me in terms of, and it's work-related, in terms of venture, I think there's a disproportionate bigger effect that an investor can have on the returns of their portfolio by the value creation side of it. I think it's very, very glamorous to say that we're good at picking good deals. I think there's definitely a skill to avoiding bad deals. But I think, you know, if there's two founders that meet the threshold of where you would invest, you have no earthly idea of working out which one's going to go on to hit that outsized return and which one hasn't. I think it's hard to codify that, but I think it's a lot easier to codify how do you support, how do you think about the right way of scaling the business, all the problems that you've seen, how do you amplify that network as an investor and bring that into the portfolio. We talked about it earlier, actually, didn't we? How many days a week do you spend on portfolio? I said broadly 40%. I think that is the bit where, as an industry, we can add value. It doesn't add maximum value. It just doesn't sound as glamorous as going,
we pick the outliers
and I'm going to pick the winner.
Yeah. I love that, because I think that is contrarian, because I think I always think about, do outlier businesses become outlier businesses? Would they become outlier businesses irrespective of whether they raise venture capital and whether they raise venture capital from the right firm? So as an example, because a firm has raised from Andreessen Horowitz, is it more likely to be successful because it raised from Andreessen Horowitz, or would it have been as successful if it had raised from ABC Ventures in New York, you know, unknown firm? Like, yeah. I always wonder whether there is, whether again, it's survivorship bias, right? Yeah. Are the best firms picking the best investments, or are those investments the best investments because they've been invested in by those big brand firms? It's a bit of a head fake, but yeah.
Yeah, it's the exact same debate as private versus public schools, isn't it? Do you have enough selection bias that the results end up going the way they do? I've not picked a view either side on either of the two. But it is it's an interesting one to think about. And again, we can't run a parallel universe. We just kind of roll with it and see what happens.
Well, unless someone invests in something really cool over the next few years. Kieran, it's been absolutely amazing having you on the podcast. For the audience, where can they find you online? You're on LinkedIn, I know you are, Twitter or elsewhere. Where can they find you?
No, you definitely can't find me on Twitter. LinkedIn is your best bet. And then if you've got a pitch that you're looking to push into Mercia, probably isn't always my desk that it's worth landing on. We're a big business. So Mercia website, contact details on there. And obviously application for anyone that wants to submit a deck. But if someone just wants an open chat with me, then definitely LinkedIn is the best social platform.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, likewise. Thanks for having me.
Awesome.